Welcome to the fourth installment of the Polycast Site Series Evergreen. I'm Wouter Locutus-Snijders. Comprising of 24 episodes and two specials, the show's fourth season began with Lisa Q&L Bang replacing original co-host Imran Siddiqui. As with previous three evergreens, Polycast regular co-host Daniel Dan Q Quick selected and ranked the 10 topics he feels most retain their relevance years after they were first published. Similarly, recurring guest co-host Canis Albinus re-listened to the entire season to select the 10 most representative moments for the show, accompanied by an honorable mention. Polycast Season 4 includes the milestone 100th episode, the first to be streamed and recorded live, and ultimately not the last, with the show retiring its pre-recorded format at season's end. Let's revisit that experience by starting its countdown from the beginning. Number 10, from episode 100, relive the much-beloved High Council from Civilization 2, as you've certainly never heard them before.
I'm concerned, Majesty. A crowd darkens our land, noble leader. And the people need entertaining. Quickly.
I disagree, Excellency.
I don't mean to be stepping on your gilded sandals, but the government will fall if we don't entertain the people.
You weak-minded eunuch.
Excellency, my rough accounting shows that trade routes to other lands would best serve the Empire.
He speaks the truth, Excellency.
We cannot sacrifice learning for luxuries.
Takes coin, not clowns, to keep an empire afloat.
My humble suggestion to your glorious person would be to build more caravans and trade with our unworthy neighbors.
Perhaps I could persuade your excellency to build embassies so that we may traffic freely with other nations.
No, your majesty. Wise men say that only fools run an empire without luxuries, king.
I disagree, Excellency.
It's barracks we need, and quickly!
That is for His Excellency to decide, Visigoth.
Remember, all things have a price, Excellency.
We need barracks, noble leader. Or would you have our soldiers sleeping on your palace steps? Give me more soldiers that they may sheathe their swords in the beating hearts of our enemies!
Dog.
Excellency, let us make currency instead of swords.
I concur, Excellency.
For it is wealth that moves the world, and profit that rules it.
Would you make peace with our enemies, Lord, or would you stick their head upon a pike?
You pig!
Our men need better weapons, Lord. Let us put the scroll heads to work on this worthy pursuit.
I concur, Your Excellency. Other nations have knowledge we need. Why not let our dull-witted swordsmen go forth and take it?
You conniving sophist!
Most honorable leader, with all due respect, we cannot run an empire without coin. Raise the taxes or hire tax collectors swiftly.
Pay them no heed, Your Majesty.
The empire would best be served by joining with another nation. There will be time enough to betray them later.
Excellency, I demand your attention!
A word, Your Excellency. The torch of knowledge sputters in your hands.
Most blessed leader, let us build marketplaces so that the peasants can barter for needed goods.
Spies and taxes be damned, your nobleness. The people need luxuries to soothe their aching hearts.
I disagree, Your Excellency.
A word, sire, if it would not trouble you. Let us research espionage in order to obtain information from other lands.
Foolishness, sire! With a good army, we can take all that we desire!
And you will suffer my wrath if you continue to spout this foolishness.
Sire, before our empire can truly grow, we need a place. Let us call it a bank in which money can be stored and lended. For a price.
Silence, vile merchants! There are other pigs to gut first!
You big oaf! Ponder matters carefully, sire, before we trifle with other nations.
I agree, sire. The very cobblestones of our street possess more learning than we do. In truth, sire, we suck.
Mind your tongue. This bloody council be damned, sire! We have mighty soldiers and the will to fight. Let us go forth!
And would you have us destroy those whom we could exploit?
Build trade routes, sire, and bring the knowledge of other cities to our doorsteps.
I agree, sire. Construct some embassies that I may sink my hooks into the hearts of other nations. You'll not regret it.
Or perhaps this wily one has her hooks in you, sire.
Pay them no heed. I cannot let the people's spirits alone, your majesty. Assist me with some luxuries and keep the people's hearts content.
I disagree, sire. The coffers lie empty. I must insist that we raise the taxes or hire more collectors forthwith.
Sire, we must keep the people happy too. Raise the luxury rate in haste, though the taxes may suffer.
The science rate ebbs low, your majesty. May I propose a small adjustment?
And may I propose a small adjustment in your wits, you who would drain the taxes from the royal coffers?
Sire, perhaps our spies or soldiers could acquire the knowledge that other lands won't grant us.
I agree, sire.
Expenses, your majesty.
Expenses be damned, sire. We need barracks, else where will our soldiers rest their mighty lances?
These matters take coin, excellency.
My lord, let us research espionage in order to obtain information from other lands.
I disagree, king.
Sire, I propose we construct more marketplaces, for all will benefit when the finest goods are traded within our cities.
I disagree, sire.
Pay them no heed, sire.
Silence, keghead. Sir, my analysis indicates that by building additional trade routes, we can interface more frequently with other nations, and ergo, ipso facto, increase the science production rate.
Trade, sir! Discover it! This is you! This is a clue! Get a clue! Discover trade!
Two words, sir. Steel technologies. That would show your perspicacity.
The man of science speaks wisdom, sir. There is a technology called espionage. I suggest you research it.
Why make what you can't fight for, General? Pay attention to your military first.
Just don't be low on my luxury rate, King.
What do you know, glitter guy?
We need more soldiers, sir. Any half-baked revolutionary can whoop our army as it stands.
Science production rates show an alarming decrease on all fronts, sir. I must insist that we correct the situation immediately. Or at least pretty soon.
Not so fast, Beaker boy. Don't let him fast talk you, General. We got other turkeys to shoot.
Only an ignoramus would choose you over technology.
Do not listen to this Sobaka, sir. We can take with cunning what he would take by force.
Where I come from, we don't fraternize with the enemy, General. How about yourself?
Sobaka.
Sir, revenues are down and our cash reserves are dropping. Raise the taxes or hire tax collectors immediately.
This bean counter's talking nonsense, General.
Sir, we must maintain our science rate.
Sir, I disagree, sir.
What do you know, lugnut?
I don't mean to be taken away from science and taxes, Your Majesty. But when the people are blue, the entertainment must be true.
I disagree, sir.
If you want to take your advice from a blue suede fool, sir, then go right ahead.
A word, General. You're sending our soldiers into battle with cap guns and bottle rockets, General. How about some support for our boys up front?
Don't listen to them, sir.
I have run the numbers out to the 10th decimal point, sir, and the results are clear. We must build more tech improvements.
The human slide rule over here would have you think money grew on trees, sir. I think not.
Oh, your lordship, the people got to be entertained.
And who will pay for all of this, sir?
I don't mean to be stepping on your blue suede shoes, but a land without luxury is like a hound dog without a bone. It's not happy.
Who cares, General? We got other itches worth scratching.
Ah, yes.
I await your further instructions.
Sorry, sir.
Number 9, from episode 90, Meeting the Definition of a Hardcore Gamer comes under scrutiny.
On the Flash of Steel strategy game blog, what is a hardcore gamer?
Me.
Were previous installments in the Civilization franchise just for hardcore gamers? And he disagreed as a what he considers himself a hardcore strategy gamer. He thinks that Civilization is somewhat softcore as far as strategy games go, having played games like Hearts of Iron or Panzer General, which is allegedly a inspiration for Civilization V.
To the extent that hexagons are.
I think that quote, it's not just for the hardcore anymore. I think that came from the preview of Civ 5 on GameSpy.
Yes.
The way the claim was substantiated in the preview is that the preview is structured into five features where the preview author claims all make it easier. Hexagons supposedly making it easier to see possible paths that you can take around the map. The change from allowing units to be, multiple units to be stacked up on a tile to one unit per tile. Easier modding. The return of advisors to the game, and then something else about cities.
That doesn't really sound like hardcore stuff. Hexagons are not actually easier for newcomers because people are accustomed to grids.
Yeah, I don't buy that either.
And I don't think any of that gets to the heart of why people do call Civilization hardcore.
Yeah.
I think the real reason they're doing that is because it takes 20, 30 hours to play a game if you're not the me and Dean. And none of those say anything about, well, the game doesn't take as long to play anymore. I mean, that's what Civilization Revolution was, really.
I think that's part of the thing, you know, is not just the length, but the why it takes so long is because there's so much depth. There's so much calculating. I don't even do half the calculating some of these people do on Civ Fanatics. Is it financially viable to build a space elevator or not, or to put this workshop there? And it can get really, really in-depth, all the way back from the first game, I think. And so I think Civilization has always been hardcore, not because of what grids it uses, but because of just how much detail it has.
Absolutely, yeah, it is very complex. And not all of it is even that well explained, although in Civ 4 I thought tutorial was very good, and the SIDS tips and the various pop-ups were all very good. Some of the basic mechanics, it took me quite a while. I had not played Civ before Civ 4.
Oh.
So some of the basic mechanics about, like, tile yields, for example, which I think the game developers tended to sort of assume that people would understand off the bat, just because everyone who developed the game had probably been playing since Civ 2 or something. I found were not very well explained, at least not for me. But on the whole, compared to some other, like, extremely nerdy games, personally I think the Civilization UI is quite good, and it's about as friendly as it can be for the level of complexity it has.
Yeah, well, UIs can always be improved, but yeah, it's not bad.
I'm sure if Phil were here, he'd be disagreeing.
On this Flash of Steel blog, which is by Troy Goodfellow, a gaming journalist who has appeared on Polycast before,
ooh,
he said in part that from where I sit, hardcore is an adjective best applied to players, not games, quote-unquote. I'm going to agree with Troy, which sounds like I'm disagreeing with some or all here on the panel, but that makes for an interesting discussion now, doesn't it?
Well, it's all about how much of yourself you want to put into the game.
You can streamline it by hitting automate and just letting your governors click the little tiles that are going to be worked and what buildings should be built, and you're just, like, basically pressing enter until the end of the game. You can make it very streamlined.
Yeah, build 3 settlers and then build every wonder.
Right, but what's the maximum difficulty you could actually win doing that on? I think there's a minimum amount you have to put into this game, and it's much higher than the minimum required by other games. That's why I think that hardcore game is applicable to Civilization IV.
Yeah.
The term certainly makes sense for both players and games, in slightly different ways.
I think it may also be just how much investment you need to make in the game in order to achieve a certain level of skill.
Yes, and for me that's why if you're a hardcore player, then you're more likely going to be able to go up the difficulty levels and not just survive, but even thrive. And so because of that scalability for Civ 4 and really for any game, I still think that when we talk about hardcore, we want to talk about the players, not the game itself. Because between that and the automation, yes, you can get into people, like you were saying, Scott, figuring out the formulas and looking at the code to save a turn or two here or there. I mean, now that is hardcore. I mean, and everything is relative. And if you're talking about those kind of people, then I'm not hardcore, but I am hardcore compared to someone who just picks up Civ 4 every now and again because I do play the game every week. If we look at, for instance, I think a lot of the times is, what does it mean to be hardcore? And if we're talking about a definition, I think the dictionary definition fits very well. Hardcore, unswervingly committed, uncompromising, dedicated, diehard, the most dedicated, unfailingly loyal faction of a group or organization. We're talking about people, we're talking about gamers in this situation, we're not talking about the game itself.
Well, I mean, I think the way language works is that terms that are applied to one concept tend to bleed out into related concepts, just because of the connotation.
Yeah.
And it may have a slightly different shade of meaning when applied to related concepts.
Like porn.
Perhaps. Let's suppose etymologically that term hardcore originally referred to people. Yeah, it could be various activities or spheres in which people engage in hardcore behavior. The other kinds of entities in those spheres, like games or whatever, might then start to themselves be called hardcore just because of the association with hardcore people. And so I just think that's the way language naturally works, is that terms sort of drift around like that to associated concepts. And so it's both.
I'm pretty sure it did originally refer to people. If you look at the way it's used in movies made in the early 80s, late 70s, they're referring to badasses, to people who do very dangerous or crazy things.
That's badass, man.
That guy's hardcore.
Huh.
I think basically what they're trying to do is keep the game from being too simple like Civ Rev and still detailed, but having the options for casual players who don't want to get too involved and be able to get off the game and have a life.
Oh, for sure. Undoubtedly, that's the goal with all versions of Civ.
Yes.
As to what Civ 5 has for us in terms of different levels of complexity, I think nobody knows yet.
I'm not even going to get into but the Civ Rev and the simple portion. That's a totally separate conversation.
I'm wondering about what the complexity level in Facebook Civ is going to be like.
Number 8, from episode 87. On Terrain Futures taking a more active, practical role in Civilization gameplay.
Oh, yeah. I love this topic. I was looking at it, and I was thinking it was just, like, a really great idea. Like, even though increases in tile yields are already important, I just don't like the idea of having mountains just not improved, ever. Not all mountains are the Himalayas, per se. You know, not only would it be closer to real life, but it would just add another interesting aspect of gameplay. And I think I agree more with the idea of assigning specific elevations, like 10,000 meters or something.
And that seemed to be a lot of what this discussion was coming into play, is what kind of scale are we going to be having here? Sea level up 500 meter intervals, or 0 to 10, or from sea level to 6,500. And it started to go off the deep end by talking about underwater cities. Ha! All right. Exactly. Thank you. Thank you. I'll be here for the rest of the recording. But I do like the idea also of elevation, and honestly, I don't care what scale we're talking about here. I don't want to get into the underwater cities thing, because then that talks about extending the technology tree, and now we're just spiraling out of control. But having it so that you either get an advantage or a disadvantage from attacking from certain elevations or defending on certain elevations is an interesting idea, and I think it can play into strategy and not be too tactical.
Yeah, I mean, as long as it doesn't conflict and wreck the balance of the game or something. But actually, the first thing that came to mind that would be problematic with it would be just, is it too computationally expensive? But if that weren't the case, I wouldn't mind seeing it in the game at all.
I see. Another problem is, visually, it would be very difficult, because 10 different elevations is kind of hard to see visually. We had to hover with your mouse, and that takes more time.
That's true. The way you'd see it would have to be done very well. Otherwise, you'd be in danger. And having it physically appear as higher or lower, which is actually what I had in mind when I said it would be more computationally expensive, that would be a way to get around that problem, but then it would look very different.
And I know I could already hear some people saying, oh, but then you get into system requirement issues and accessibility to the game, because perhaps you could have like low-end graphics or something like that, and then it wouldn't be represented that way. Then it would have to be represented with a bunch of a text or something like that. I mean, that's kind of a side issue. But as soon as you started getting into trying to represent that on screen, for it to be able to be, as I said, as natural as possible, so that you could tell at a glance what it was without being too distorted or too blocky or something like that. Like in Civilization 4, you've got a resource display that you can toggle, for example. Perhaps something along those lines.
Yeah, but something on every tile would be distracting.
Well, you could have it so that wherever there was a change in elevation, that would be marked so that it wouldn't end up being on every particular tile. Now, in terms of, well, what direction are you going from? The change in elevation from the north, east, south, west, or whatever, yeah, you'd have to decide on that.
I don't see a way it could be done without actually drawing it in as going up and down on elevation, which might be feasible, but maybe not right away. Maybe we have to wait for machines to catch up to that sort of thing. Also, ESIF 4 could do a lot better with how it handles its resources. It draws a lot of computing power, despite the fact that it's a turn-based strategy game. So they'd have to get around that issue if they were going to make it even more demanding.
Civilization 5, coming to an IMAX theater near you.
Yeah, pretty much.
Forget your glasses.
If you have a terabyte processor, then go ahead.
Glasses sold separately. Don't.
Number 7, from episode 108, a case for discarding the worker unit in the series.
We know that in the Civilization series, they have been gotten rid of, sort of, both in Civilization Revolution as well as in Cult of Power. Now, Civilization Revolution does not come up in this thread, but Cult of Power does. CGG1066 says, here's my suggestion. By working a tile, the relevant improvement, so farms on plains, grassland, lumber mill on forest, etc., would be built automatically after a set number of turns. No worker needed. You get the improvement built where you need it. No micromanagement. No AI workers doing things and going places you don't want. There was a similar thread that was linked to that was started a couple of weeks before. Just talked about, I don't think you ever need workers on the map to move them around for improving to getting resources. You can just make it more comfortable just right-clicking on a tile to improve, so no overlapping with troops. Now, the thing about no micromanagement, I think there's still going to be
a lot.
Some micromanagement required. First off, that the relevant improvement would be built. Lumber mill on forests.
What if it's before you can build a lumber mill?
Well, that too.
What if you want to chop down the forest and build a farm? It needs a pop-up menu that you pick what you want anyway. It's just as much management.
And what happens when the barbarians start stacking all of your improvements?
And what if I don't want a farm on the plain grassland? What if I want a trading post?
Yeah.
He's kind of going in from the general idea to some of the specifics, and I'm hitting on some of these specifics right now. But some people brought in, as I said, a Cult of Power public work system, and I think, Matt, you can speak better to CivRev, and I don't, if any of us here really played much of Cult of Power, I did not.
Well, enough that I know how that worked. It was like you put a little bit of your economy into the pool of public works, and you bought them by public works points, basically.
And you were able to choose what that improvement was going to be.
Yes.
So both the tile as well as how that tile would be improved based on what you could build?
Yes.
On the micromanagement side, that's not any less. You still have to pick what you want where, and do you have the funds to do it now? I don't see how that's any less micromanagement, except for having to occasionally move the worker someplace.
I think or occasionally cuss the worker out for getting caught.
Yeah, it removes that whole strategic option of stealing workers.
I think that Barry just has a big problem with building workers and putting them in the build queue and stuff like that. About the trading posts, in the post he says that he wants to lose them because they're ugly. And the next iteration of Civ should have a much more sophisticated and intuitive economy anyway, which, okay, I can see that.
Okay, program your own Civ game.
Yeah, I've seen that argument too. Get rid of trading posts because they look ugly. Okay, well, like, seriously?
How about change the graphics because they look ugly?
Yeah, that's how it is.
Exactly.
Trading posts just look like money to me, so I'm okay with them. If I look at the screen and I see a whole bunch of trading posts, that means that I'm rich.
Ka-ching!
You just see dollar signs.
Oh.
Oh, you should get your eyes checked out, Matt. They don't look anything like dollar signs. I don't know what's going on.
Maybe you should get your eyes checked.
There you go.
Maybe we should both get our eyes checked. What do you think of that?
That's a great idea.
Well, I agreed first, so.
Right.
He's not even getting rid of workers completely, so you would still have to build them, which, it's like, what's the point? Why not have workers anyway?
Still use workers to build roads. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of weird. You might as well keep them if you're going to, I mean, I don't know. In SivRev, there are no workers. If you want a road, you just pay for it and it's there.
And the road is directly from one city to another.
Right. Yeah, you don't have any choice. It just goes the quickest path to the next city. And if there's no path, then you can't build it. There are no real tile improvements. There are buildings that you can build that make a tile better, kind of like the mint in Civ 5, which will make your precious metal producing tiles better. Plus 3 gold or something like that. Same idea. In Civ 5, I find workers a little weird, because by the end of the game, I usually have captured so many, and I do delete some of them if I don't need them, but it seems like only a limiting factor in the beginning of the game, when maybe I can steal one, maybe I have to make one myself, maybe barbarians will come and take it or something like that, but once I'm past that phase, then really I have workers coming out of my ears and can get anything I want right away. So that doesn't seem probably exactly what was intended.
My biggest issue with workers in Civilization 5 is they don't stack. So rather than having a couple of workers on a particular hex, and of course not only are they combined, so I'm having to move less workers less, they can actually complete things more quickly, but having to go, okay, say I've got 10 workers, I would often pair 2 workers together, and so if all of them have to move to go do something, now I have to do that 10 times as opposed to 5.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to stick to not only the 1 unit per hex, but we're not going to give an exception to, say, these particular non-combat units, then the trade-off then becomes if we put it into the city screen, like the person here talks about, yeah, beneath city allocation, to have place works, Shatter God. So this would be within the city screen itself. So now it's, yeah, there's still micromanagement. We're just deferring that from the screen as far as units to move around and putting it within the city screen. I do think you lose some micromanagement slightly because of not having to actually move the workers themselves, that you could say, okay, this is within my cultural borders, build this particular improvement here. 1 or 2 clicks as opposed to 2 or 3 in terms of moving a worker. I would actually like this, or allow me to stack my workers. That I think I can get around my feel for needing them, not having workers, that I can manage, okay, in terms of the time to complete my turn, yeah, I want to be able to think what it is I'm doing, but it's like, okay, you go here, and you go here, and you go there, or actually be able to tell them, okay, I want you to go here first and build this improvement, and go here and then build that improvement. So then if I can't stack my workers, at least I'm only going to say have to move them maybe half the time.
I think the whole idea of workers is a little odd, because workers will improve a tile, like make a grassland into a farm, but then to get food off that farm, I need to put a citizen there, and a worker's not a citizen. He doesn't live anywhere. I guess he's a slave, and he just wanders around building things that I tell him to build. It has nothing to do with the overall population of my empire. Like, I could have 20 workers and a single one population city, or I could have 30 population cities and 1 worker.
At some point, they cost money if you have too many.
It's true. They do cost maintenance. That one city probably can't support 20 workers. But it just seems a little weird. Some of the things that you do with a worker, and some of the things that come from the city, but it's all, in my mind, it would be work. Like, building a farm is work, and working a farm is, I think, by definition, work. It's a little, I think, unintuitive at first, but something that Civ players have gotten used to.
I kind of like them, but getting rid of them would solve the problem that I always have. That if there's a barbarian or enemy in my territory, my workers will find them and move right next to them.
Don't automate them.
I don't, but the pathfinding when moving from point A to point B,
pathfinding.
If it's possible to move next to an enemy unit,
yes.
They will. I lose, I think, at least 2 workers every game that way, just because they're supposed to stop when they see the enemy, but they never do. They always move right next to them and then end their turn.
Well, at least in Civilization 5, you have the potential to get them back.
Yeah, in Civ 4, the AI always just kills workers.
And for them, too. Heaven forbid they try to use it to their advantage.
Yeah. On the other hand, the whole micromanagement issue, a lot of people like the micromanagement. It's why they play Civilization instead of some more streamlined game. You can control things in pretty detail, and the managing is what they like. To some extent, that's true for me. I like controlling all of these things. Then we get to the whole possible me and team argument. He really hates working unimproved tiles. And based on the original proposition where you the tile for a while and it develops the improvement, I suspect he'd hate that. You'd have to work unimproved tiles.
He would hate that, but maybe not if that's the way that I was born.
Number 6 from episode 94. A related case to the last, considering doing away with the settler unit.
This thread was started by Decimatus. I know it is practically the core of the franchise. Basically, we want to make the worker into the dynamic for city building. Let's call them citizen units. So it all revolves around the worker even more so than it already does now. My interpretation, not quoting from him. Quoting from him again. You start out in your capital. A city's population is all contained inside the original square, and any that it expands into over time. Anytime you have more than one population, you can spend a couple of turns to push out a citizen unit, which lowers the city population by one. This citizen unit can basically set down on a workable tile anywhere it can walk to. When it does, that tile has an effective population of one or more if it turns into a villager town. However, the further it is away from your city, the less your empire benefits from its product, be that food, resources, etc. Once that area of citizen reaches a certain level of commerce or production, you get an event prompt that asks you which local tile you want to place the city hall for the new city. Bam, you have a new city that can start growing and furthering your empire. At the same time, you can have citizen units all over the place pouring resources into your empire, however inefficiently if they are far from a city, unquote, like you mentioned before. And then later on in some follow-up posts, after some initial feedback, he says, quote, having citizen units instead of settlers doesn't take away government planning or pre-planned city constructions. It simply makes it more natural. The ability for the citizen units to change the game into a more organic system based on population rather than cities would be a good change for the genre, unquote. Razor Wing, post number 14. Realism is good and all, but if it doesn't add to the fun of the game, it doesn't have a chance of being added in. As described, and it is quite detailed in some parts, a little confusing here and there, needing to read a couple of his posts to really get your mind wrapped around it, but maybe it is more realistic, but I don't see the advantage over the current system, and as Kamikaze, he says, the major problem I can see is the computer's inability to choose suitable locations for founding cities. I mean, they kind of have that issue already to a certain degree.
Yeah.
So I just think that this is making it more complicated for the human, and so if you're talking about single-player games or multiplayer game, wherever there's an AI, it's just going to be that much more complicated. I commend the kind of thinking out of the box, and it sounds interesting in theory, but I don't think in practice it would be that desirable.
It is an interesting idea, but it isn't something I'd like to see in Civ. The guy basically said it himself, that the settler is a key element in the franchise, but it isn't just that. If you think about it in any of the known Civ models that we've played to date, I know I'm being old school here. You would need to change a lot of things that he's addressed so far. Like, what do you do when you conquer somebody else's city? How does your culture factor in against their culture then? Or what do you do when you get unbalanced starts in terms of aggressive settling, which might have saved you before? Now you can't do that. So now you're stuck on that peninsula forever, basically, because you couldn't get out of there in time. I know you could say just balance the starting system better, but that's not so easy to do. There's a lot of factors that would make this difficult to implement beyond the fact that it's just getting away from standard playing that we're used to. And I don't really have a huge problem with the whole settler thing. I mean, as someone else pointed out, people don't just live in cities anyway. They also live all around them. So the settler model is flawed just the same as the regular city model is flawed in Civ. Overall, it's an interesting idea. It's fun to think about it, but I can't really picture it in a Civ game.
Yeah, I think Phil makes a good point. That'd be good material for some other game, probably not Civ. We're constantly having this issue with Civ here, where Just because civilization uses the names of real leaders, real civilizations, and real cities doesn't necessarily mean that it's trying to be an approximation of real life. One thing that I do have a problem with is vast numbers of people simply don't venture out in unison to found new cities. That is Alpha Centauri stuff. That was in the first post of this thread. I would kind of disagree with that.
Just to further kind of what the last post thread of this recording says, a system that features uncontrolled organic settlement is fine, but it cannot replace the settler unit. It would have to exist alongside planned settlement. I guess I could see you trying to do that, a kind of a way we have that. We can have villages that then grow into colleges, and that there are people there, but that really doesn't count towards population. That's commerce, which indirectly, of course, then influences how well your city can grow, and then your city can grow from that, but it's not so direct in that sense. So I suppose you could work within that system to add some kind of, as I said, organic settlement, as it was described here, but replacing the settler unit, I guess, is what I was kind of focusing on. There would be still a fair bit of game balance considerations in there in terms of what Phil said at other points as well.
I think Civ is a game of choices that you have to make, and one of the things that I always find myself doing is deciding what the pros and cons of any choice are. To build a settler, your city stops growing, takes some number of turns, and most importantly, it's where I want to put it. I can take a settler and I can settle where I want to. If this would still have some of the upside and downside kind of aspects to making the decision and still give you the control where, instead of sort of in a nomadic way, your cities kind of pop up, I guess I'd be willing to consider it, but I do kind of like the settler model.
Number 10. From episode 91.
Now that I think about it, if each city has its own Swiss Army knife, you know, Swiss Army knives kind of suck. You don't really get that much done with a Swiss Army knife.
You'd much rather have an assault rifle, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I use to cook my food.
Yeah.
You just shoot it until it's cooked.
Number 9. From episode 93.
The next Windows is just going to be Civ, and it will be the operating system. And then you'll be trying to use some of the other things for it, you'll be writing a paper or something, and it'll come up, pop a little bubble, and say, Civ.
See, it'll be integrated into the next version of Windows, so that when it thinks it's time for you to play Civ, it'll just automatically start Civ and say, you play now.
So basically, it just runs Civ right when you turn it on, it just stays on Civ no matter what.
First time, it should say that, and then there's an OK button, and then there could be a little checkbox that says, don't warn me next time, and then it loads.
That's awesome. Or make two buttons and have one say yes and the other one say OK. That would be kind of fun, too.
And if you try to click X or you try to shut down the operating system, it just formats your hard drive. There's no way you can get around it.
You will play Civ. Your new AI master decrees it.
Number 8. From episode 85.
That's what I was going to say! Oh no! Emma and I should not be on the same wavelength.
Oh no! We're sharing a brain.
Oh no!
I think all four of us have started sharing a brain at some point.
Number 7, from episode 98.
I just like it as a physical copy in addition to the digital copy. And maybe it's a nostalgic thing. Maybe it's actually, oh, you know, my shelves don't look so bare anymore. Everybody loves to furnish their living accommodations with
video game boxes.
Exactly.
Come over to my house. Look at my civilization paraphernalia.
Hey, baby.
One more turn?
Number 6. From episode 90.
America, Germany, Aztec and Inca, Japan, China, Arabia, Mongolia, Rome, France, India, England, Russia, the Ottomans, Egypt and Greece. That's the end of the list.
Number 5. From episode 105. To annex or not to annex a Civilization V captured city is analyzed.
Why bother annexing anything? Oh, great. Of course, it has a difficult pronounced post name. Okay, this was post was started by Zeknichov. I think I got that right. If I did not, I apologize.
Or Zeknikov.
Zeknikov. Okay, I'll say it both ways, and then if you know one or the other is right, there you go.
Right. You were both right and wrong at the same time.
Listeners, you can self-edit that. Whichever way I said it that was correct, yeah, just go with that one.
Unless it's both wrong, in which case, ignore that whole explanation. But anyway.
Yeah, exactly. once in a while, bother annexing anything, especially puppets, focus gold. Just build one to five main cities and puppet everything else. Your happiness and culture benefits more than annexing. He almost doesn't see the point of annexing. He says, well, it may not be a problem. He just doesn't see the basically the strategic benefit in annexing. The dominant strategy in Civ 5 versus alternative strategies, there really isn't much disincentive other than some social policies to just spamming cities and getting huge as soon as you can, or it's usually more cost-effective and happiness-effective to just take a bunch of puppet cities constantly. Even before the patch, if you gave puppets lots of trading posts or whatever, they would not have built too many expensive buildings. So they would essentially become gold factories for you anyway. This just makes it a little bit more convenient, a little bit more control over the puppets. But again, it doesn't change the fundamental issue that maybe that's just a little bit too strong. I don't have the answer there, but when it comes to annexing something, the only draw for that is control of the city. If you have good production in the city, you might want it, like, for, say, hammer out your courthouse quickly, and now you have a good wonder-producing city, or another unit-producing city. You can only buy so much, and the puppet cities won't necessarily produce the gold buildings that you want, especially if you tell them to just build gold. You're not going to get as much out of them as you would otherwise. But yeah, I would say the conquest thing is a little bit too strong relative to other strategies, and then it's really difficult to completely fill out the social policy trees or even get decently into them if you expend at all. So the balance between that and going for culture is just a little off-kilter in my opinion. I would like to see some balance between your options in this game, rather than everybody just paying off maritime civs and conquering as soon as they possibly can, as much as they possibly can, and abusing trades.
His thread is titled, Why Bother Annexing Anything? So it makes it sound like he's totally against it, but yet then you actually read in his post where he says, I almost don't see the point. It's like, okay, it didn't quite fit with what your thread title is. But like him, I'll puppet anything unless it's like capital or something where I really, really prefer having control of the city.
Yeah.
I just find it interesting that his subject or his statements don't quite agree with the title he chose.
If you get really huge, you're going to want the happiness structures, but you're not going to have the ability to tell the puppets to build them. So eventually you might need to start annexing them just to finish the courthouse and then quickly get other happiness structures so you can do anything at all. So there's that as well. That could be a problem. Because ultimately you can get more happiness from an annexed city than you would from a puppet city dedicated to gold. It takes longer, but once you get the Colosseum Theater in there, it's almost guaranteed that that's producing more happiness than you're losing out on annexing.
Courthouses need to be either you can buy them or something, because it takes too long to build the stupid things in an annexed town.
Yeah, you really need a good hammer city to build them in a reasonable time, unfortunately.
And I realize they're trying to make it so it's a little bit more difficult on you, but it's a little bit too much now.
Yeah. Well, I think the conquest approach in general is too strong. People are just using puppets instead, whatever. You could look at some balance between annexing and puppeting, but I think the big priority right now is just doing something about the returns or just rushing everybody ASAP, other than city-states. You just kill all the AIs that you can reach.
Martino guy argues in here, he brings up, it's not just a question of annex or even puppeting. Of course, your other choice is, of course, raise, raise, raise. And he argues that your best bet is to do just that and then resettle, 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 just to get around the obscene and extortion-like cost of maintaining an annex city. I don't necessarily think that's the case. In part, it depends back to, like, the production capability also when you're trying to decide, for instance, whether you're just going to leave it as a puppet or you're going to annex. What's the point, for instance, of raising a city that's not going to have very good production and then just turn around and settle it yourself that's also not going to have very good production?
Well, if you have a maritime city-state that gives you food every turn, because if you annex that, it's never going to be able to build anything. Even that courthouse is going to take forever. So it's going to be a happiness drain right away. Whereas if you settle it, it's going to grow pretty quickly. Then it'll be workable from that standpoint. Like, you won't have to deal with the unhappiness. Essentially, you're outsourcing the courthouse costs to another city, plus you don't have to eat the maintenance for the courthouse for the rest of the game. So there is some benefit from that standpoint. The reason you would annex a city is if it has a lot of good buildings in it already, or it has a lot of culture, or it has enough production to actually build the courthouse sometime this year.
Okay, yeah, so there's particular circumstances where that would be beneficial, but these just, like, your best bet, like, just kind of a general approach to raise, 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 and resettle, resettle, resettle.
Yeah, sure, I'll raise a city that has, like, five wonders in it, because it's cheaper to resettle.
Plus, it's nice, too, that you actually keep the culture.
Yes.
I like that feature.
And that has some potential strategic value, too, if you're going to continue a war and you're looking at moving from the city you just captured onto another city. If you raise it, the culture from the other city could start becoming a little bit of a problem.
Some people are whining and are all, oh, they don't sack my cities automatically. Boo.
Yeah, as if that was fun.
Yeah.
Number 4 from episode 102. Following in and helping to maintain the tradition of civilization as an educational tool, now on set 4 specifically.
There's a link in the topic to an article in Melbourne Metropolitan Newspaper about them using it to educate primary school kids. Now, I'm not going to try this guy's username because it's letters and a bunch of numbers.
Yeah, he's a piece of hardware.
Yes. Yeah, Mr. Random Hardware started this and also put an interesting poll there up at the top, all sorts of options. I love that there's in one here that says, say what? It's educational. I'm Gary, Diversion Therapy Works, man.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Well, what are you teaching when you're playing Civ 4 or making other people play Civ 4?
You teach a little bit of history, I think. I remember when I first started playing, like, I would poke around the Civilopedia a lot. You learn a lot that way. And I think I mentioned it before that it's better in World History because I played Civ a lot. Although I didn't really play it while I was doing my homework or anything. Games, like, I think, can be a good teaching tool. I mean, I remember when I was in elementary school, I used to play this game called Pharaoh. I don't know if you
guys have
ever played it.
I do.
Oh, that was used in my school as an educational tool, and the teacher was just like, oh, yeah, you can play it, you know, to learn more about the pharaohs, but then I ended up, you know, just playing it. Like, it's during free time.
Well, now you know why it took so long to build those huge pyramids.
Too many hammers. Yeah, see, the next time you play the drinking game Circle of Death and somebody picks an asinine topic like ancient cities, you are no longer screwed, because you just get to think about the capitals of most of the civilizations in this game, and you are set.
See, it's good for all age levels, from primary school to college.
Absolutely. All kinds of applications. It could also be used to teach game theory. Yeah, just put people on a really, really crowded continent and have the kids start warrior rushing each other and see who comes out on top. It should be a fun exercise, I think.
Or give them a custom scenario where it's 11 billion spearmen in one tank.
That's more to teach them ahead of time the troubles with the random number generator, I think.
See? You're still learning.
You learn that the random number generator hates you. And you learn it young. It's a good lesson to learn young, I suppose.
It is.
Some people are like, no, Civ 4 is an educational tool for history. Boo, boo, boo.
Yeah, they're saying go play Europa Universalis. And kids at the level that they're talking about, there is no way they could get into that game.
No. There's a balance. I mean, yes, you want children to learn, but really, when they come away with an education, how much are they going to remember in terms of the content itself? Maybe 5%, maybe 10%. You want them to be able to understand the process. You want them to be able to analyze and think critically and decide, okay, is this worth it? Is it more likely to be that I'm going to get ahead or behind if I do this? That kind of thinking is really what you're trying to get at. And the history does come out of it because at least talk about you jump into the Civilopedia and then hopefully you want to find out more. Or you then begin to wonder, I'm experiencing this in the game. I wonder if this is how people really experience that in quote-unquote real life. And so you could use Civ 4, I mean, like it says, as an educational tool. It's not Civ 4 as education, period.
I prefer light-bulbing that technology.
Please everyone note that Dan is a hopeless idealist who believes that education is actually capable of causing critical thinking.
But playing Civ is capable of causing critical thinking.
Doing well requires it. I don't know if it causes it, though.
You want to try to engage people, particularly young people, but not just anybody. If you can make it into a game and something that they're actually going to recognize, then it's kind of one of those situations. It's like, you know, with edutainment, I'm learning something?
Yeah.
Just don't tell them that. Just don't tell them they're actually learning something and you're good to go. No.
Especially if they're studying, for example, the Roman Empire, and you can show them with a specific Civ 4 map for playing the Romans and conquering the rest of Europe. The TAM mod. It's got a lot of good stuff in it, and it just concentrates on that era, on the classical era.
Yeah, I think when you're talking about content specific,
You can have like a free-for-all game with some parameters, but actually having a specific scenario depending upon what era of history you're looking at, what it is that you're expecting students to demonstrate and produce and show you that you know, I think specific scenarios and or mods would help in that particular circumstance. I think what really surprised me more about this article was the age that they were gearing the game towards. We have seen it talked about in high schools and in colleges and universities before, but elementary age children, I mean 10 and 11 year olds.
They're smarter than you think.
I don't see why not. I could have done it at that age. I mean, I played Civ 2 at that age and could handle it, so I'm sure they can.
I'm not saying they can't. I mean, 7 and 8, like 13 and 14 year olds, but 10 and 11? Oh, hey, good for them.
My 5-year-old nephew's starting to be able to read. I bet within a year or two, if I actually got him interested in the game somehow, I could get him beating Noble. I bet.
Yeah, you should have him play with us.
Well, maybe our environment wouldn't be so good.
It's also kind of past his bedtime at this point.
It would be pretty impressive to end up pool that has a bunch of 8-year-olds each, and every one of them wants to take over the world.
Well, yes, we have to make sure we keep them rooted in reality somehow. Random Piece of Hardware is ultimately asking, when a game becomes mainstream and ends up being used in schools as an educational tool, does it stop being fun to play? Which is an interesting angle that I've never seen anybody take before. Does it stop being fun to play? No.
No. Or if you're one of those people that, oh, it's mainstream now, I don't want to play it.
Now, it was recorded for the first pilot and released in Episode 7. We looked at the same topic. Well, I don't think it was Civ 4 specifically. It was just Civ in general as an educational tool. Automated Teller says, someone in Canada did this either for 3 or 4 some years ago. It's true. It was for early Canadian history, 1500s to the 1700s, and it was Civilization 3 based. And as a matter of fact, just won an award last year, even though that game has been out for a few years now. Kudos to them. I mean, the thread has some interesting comments. I think the ones that kind of had me going, what? A couple people, like John Falcon, 99977, says, haha, that's a good joke, right? And then BitPlayer said, if this is for real, then it is retarded. You're welcome to your opinion, but can you explain why you think it is quote-unquote retarded? He hasn't really elaborated on what he means by that. And I read that and I think you're just jealous you didn't get a chance to play Civ 4 when you were in school. And you know,
that's it right there.
I feel the same way.
I was about to say, all I got was Oricon Trail.
I didn't have that experience, but there was something called an ICON, which is a computer built specifically for use in schools, and it was actually created by the Ontario Ministry of Education. What the ICON was, workstation housed in a large steel case with a fully sized keyboard mounted slightly left of center, and it had a trackball mounted to the right, but it had no hard drive. Everything went to a central server.
Mainframe.
Yeah, mainframe. You had a dummy terminal. And there was software there. It was a 4-part game on Canadian history called The Bartlett Saga. And it was about...
It's about the West Wing?
The West Wing of Canada. Oh, I guess we could stretch it that way. Settling the prairies. You took on the role of, as kind of was implied, a Bartlett, and you were trying to settle and build a life for yourself and your family, and you had to deal with stuff like random events, like locusts. Why do I remember that? Anyway, so...
Even back then.
I know. Let's go to your happy place. It can be educational, and it can be fun. If people are already playing the game, then that's a benefit to not only that student, but the other students in the class and the teacher, because then the teacher doesn't have to be the only one that's an expert. And in fact, I guess maybe the only downside is you might go into the game knowing more than anybody else, but by the time the kids are done playing it, they know more than you, but that's okay. The real barrier to Civ 4 as an education tool, or any computer game as an educational tool, is, gee, money. Let's talk about this briefly. I'm thinking in this topic on what other educational tools, like in terms of games that I've played, I think of the ICONs and the Bartlett Saga, but I also think of Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
I haven't played that for years.
Me neither. I still have the deluxe edition of Where's Carmen Sandiego on my shelf in the original box, original documentation, original discs, everything. Seven Cities of Gold as well, and we know especially Seven Cities of Gold influenced a number of people who have been involved in Civilization's development, including Sid Meier himself. So There we go. If we want the Civilization franchise to continue, we need more people. We need more students at an earlier age to be exposed to Civilization so they can help continue to make great games such as Civ. And perhaps something even better than Civ. Dare I say.
There's things better than Civ.
I know.
Number 3 from episode 104. Considering the merits and possibilities of having a unit workshop akin to that found in Alpha Centauri brought into the Civ series.
We've talked about the Alpha Centauri system here, and I didn't play much of Alpha Centauri myself.
Heathen.
So I had my teeth hooked into Civ 2, but also it was just how, by default, how dark things were on the screen. But I still value what Alpha Centauri had in a lot of respects. And so, for those wondering, this Alpha Centauri system was described in a separate thread on 2K. It was actually linked to by Stepan. For those who have played more of Alpha Centauri, I think this is a reasonable description, the little that I remember. So instead of a single technology equaling a new unit, Alpha Centauri did it a little differently. We've heard that a new technology unlocking of a new platform, and if I recall correctly, Galactic Civilizations from Stardock is similar in this respect, too.
You didn't unlock units, you unlocked components of units, which you then built up blueprints and built up your own combinations from that.
And it would provide a new name for the unit based on what you'd upgraded, and you could even customize that yourself if you preferred.
Stepa says in Civ terms, this would be a person on foot, a person on horseback, a cannon, etc. Each platform had 5 or 6, he says, if memory serves, slot that could be updated, such as a weapon, armor, power unit like health or special abilities, amphibious, and so on. In Civ terms, as you progress up through the text, your infantry get better weapons and armor, which what Alex and Stewart have been talking a lot about. But Stepa says, my point is that there has been no apparent widespread desire to see something like that in Civ, other than the special ability upgrades we've seen in the last couple of iterations, promotions. I wonder about that because I thought AC's approach allowed for remarkable diversity in strategy. And Slow Target says he doesn't think it works for Civilization, but it was because, quote, people ended up continually making the same units, thus eroding most of the fun of having flexibility, quote unquote. I'm not entirely sold on having something like Alpha Centauri, but if the reason for not having it is because of how people used it, then I think it's more of a question of tweaking the system itself so it's not people ending continually making the same things. In Civilization 4, you do have the ability to get some new promotions when you get a particular technology. Gunpowder, for instance, you now get the pinch promotion for mounted units, for example, first thing that comes to mind. But to me, there needs to be at some point where there's, like, restrictions on the type of promotions an older unit can get so it could get upgrades through a combination of technology and also through a successful combat performance. Then it's like, okay, we've done as much as we can with this unit through technology and through its own ability in battle, just as kind of gameplay balance to the realism thing. Then if you want to go beyond that, you need this next classification. But that tricky balance is, of course, so that you don't end up with half a dozen different types of the same thing, because I think that throws not only longstanding players off, but also makes it more complicated for newer people looking to come into the game.
One thing I'd say is the Alpha Centauri system, although when you research a new tech, it would give you a couple of basic blueprints automatically based on what other technologies you already had, you had to get a new unit. You had to design your blueprint to get it how you wanted. Then you had to build your prototype, which was more expensive. Then you built the units regularly. And also, you had only so many blueprints. You could upgrade the blueprint to a new unit, and that would upgrade all your units of one type to another. But it got rather complicated, whereas what might work better would be an amalgam between the Alpha Centauri method and the Civilization Promotions method, where you could build your basic unit. It's a basic unit wandering around in the world. It's already built, and then you give it the weapons, give it the armor to make it into your own thing. You don't worry about blueprints. You just promote it into what type of unit you need it to be. You're promoting it to a rifleman, promoting it to a machine gunner, etc., etc.
You've got, like, you've discovered feudalism. You now can access chainmail.
Yeah.
And so you go in and you find your old swordsmen and you equip them now with chainmail. So now they're medieval swordsmen or something.
It was a good idea with having to build a prototype. But then again, you can just make it the first unit you upgrade their equipment on. The upgrade is slightly more expensive and then gets cheaper later on.
I don't think you'd even need, like, a prototype for most of the Civ stuff because it's just infantry and cavalrymen for most of the game.
Yeah. You could limit the prototypes to weapons or something.
Or giant death robots.
You limit it to the weapons, whereas the armor, you don't have to worry about prototyping. The other features, like having a medic unit, having a recon unit that can camouflage themselves, hide in the undergrowth, and things like that, those sorts of promotions, those don't need prototypes, but the weapons need prototypes, because you don't want them to blow up in the face of the unit that's using them.
Well, like if you had cannons, for example, you know, the first ones you get might be those primitive, early medieval ones that tended to blow up in your face and accidentally kill your unit. So you could go through a sort of technological development with more advanced weaponry where you discover what doesn't work.
Actually, if you built a new unit to take advantage of this new technology and gave him a hand cannon, then you have a small chance of the cannon blowing up and killing that unit. However, if you took your most experienced unit and gave him a new weapon, he's got his experience behind him to know when it might blow up, and that will lessen your chance of killing him.
Sure.
And then once you, say, had five turns with a unit that hasn't killed himself, then the chance is gone forever. You can start giving it out to all your units.
Something like that, yeah. A lot of that stuff would have to happen behind the lines, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, probably need a lot of balance, but it would certainly be interesting to think about, if nothing else.
Yeah, a lot of default automation as well, just for people who are just like, oh, just let the game make a lot of these decisions.
Yeah, because there was a lot of people who played Alpha Centauri that just used the default units.
Yeah.
So, say, you've gained access to the mace. You can just start building macemen, or you can go through and retrofit all your swordsmen with maces, or you can customize so that you have a unit with a sword and a mace, or whatever you want to do.
A sword and a mace, so perhaps the sword has one bonus, the mace has a different bonus, and the bonuses are halved if he's got both, but he has both types of bonus. Like the sword might be better against infantry, the mace is better against a unit on horseback, because you can whack it and knock them off the horse, for example.
Something like that, yeah.
So you've got those two bonuses, but the bonus is that maybe the actual values are halved, because he's got both.
To prevent uberness.
Yeah.
So, like, with the Persian Immortals that I mentioned earlier, got bows, spears, and swords, but they don't get as big of bonuses.
They're not specialized in any specific one, but they are very versatile.
Yeah.
You got breadth of skills, not depth.
Yeah.
Or you get a limited amount that you can make as well, or something like that, since they're so elite.
Yeah, well, so that's why you can have a unique base unit. So you could have a unit as well as just a unique weapon. So you'd have your unique unit, which, instead of carrying two weapons, can carry three, for example.
Sure.
I think that is actually playing in very well to Pro Cylon's post in this thread. By your command. What she's saying, that a good compromise to all of this would be if you allowed, basically, to create 2 to 3 of your own unique units every era that you have to stick with once you have designed them. She says, I think this will work a lot better in a game like Civ since it has many trade-offs. Unique bomber and unique battleship, or unique tank and unique submarine. Decisions like that make for some very different wars.
Yeah, using the blueprint system or the promotion system, you design your unique unit, you lock that down, and then you can quickly produce those cheaply, and they're automatically promoted up to the unique unit level, but you're locked at that as your unique unit. You making it unique makes it cheaper for you to produce that type of unit.
But you've used up one of your unique slots.
Yeah, what was I? But the thing is, because you custom design it, another player could custom design the same unit. But if you've declared it as your unique unit, it makes it more expensive for them and cheaper for you to produce it, perhaps.
Another advantage of this system would also be that the game could recognize certain units that you've produced as unique units, or at least give them like a unique name. So you don't just have each Civ having one or two unique units, because the game is recognizing several of the things that you've produced with unique names. So like German tanks, you get the Panzers, but then like your knights, you could get Teutonic knights if you equip them with the right combination of equipment.
Like in RPGs where you get set bonuses if you've got all armor from the same set.
So like if your German knight is equipped with a lance and a certain kind of armor and some other item and some skill, congratulations, you've unlocked Teutonic knight.
Yeah.
By this combination.
And because of that, yeah, he gets the set bonus and the unique bonus on top of his regular bonus, but...
That's very complex, though, so it would probably need to be streamlined.
Yeah. This, I suppose that goes back to the, you don't unlock the unique unit, you unlock the unique weapon or unique armor, and so you can build regular chainmail macemen, or you can have something else. You can have splintmail, but creates a unique unit by adding those two combinations.
Well, and there would be different strategy behind it. So, like, you've unlocked chainmail, but it's more expensive than the, I don't know, the leather armor that you've been using up to this point or whatever. And so you can continue to use the older weapons and armor for cheaper units, but they won't gain the bonuses from the new stuff if you want.
Of course, you have things obsoleting after a while, but they're not automatically obsoleted when you get a new tech.
Yeah.
It'll be 3 or 4 techs down the line.
Yeah, absolutely.
So leather armor would be obsolete by the time you've got modern reactive nanoweave armor or whatever. But
yeah.
When you've got your chainmail and your plate mail, it's not obsolete yet. Leather armor for the cannon fodder is still
viable.
Yeah.
Dan is skeptical.
No, what I was thinking first off, especially the difference in the technology, it made me think of the Civilization Daydreams comic by Tim Buckley with the guy with the sword, and he sees someone with, he's like a marine with a gun. He's like, well, that's a funny-looking sword. What do you think you're going to be able to do with that? And then he finds out it's a lot better than a sword. But one of the things that I liked, for example, with Beyond the Sword was the ability, in addition to random personalities, was the unrestricted leaders in the sense that, okay, civilization for some people is about recreating history. And that's where you get into the scenarios and some of the more specialized mod packs. To me, reimagining history. So instead of just Egypt having those war chariots, Spain should have them, or Korea, or whatever. And so now, especially when we're talking about pro-Cylon's suggestion of having like 2 or 3 unique units, this is just taking it to a more extreme, where if you knew, for example, that Egypt had a war chariot, then if you had enough contact, enough exposure to Egypt, then why couldn't, say, another civilization also be able to design their own war chariot, but at the same time have some sort of restriction, some sort of variation, so it wasn't quite exactly the same, so then perhaps you don't get into the same problem with the criticism about the Alpha Centauri unit builder, which is everybody just ends up building the same darn thing, because they are the ones that are the most powerful.
Liking your idea there, it sounds a lot like cultural diffusion to me, where, like, the Greeks are coming along with their hoplites or phalanxes or whatever. People are like, hey, this is a good idea. And then you can create a unit that uses that fighting style but uses the weapons of the local culture or whatever, or, like, different civilizations that tried to copy the Roman legion in one form or another, where they're trying to copy the weaponry or whatever the unit has, but they're doing it in their own way.
I'm just having this vision of Mega Bears fan perhaps listening to this podcast, and he's kind of like, how did you guys start on sonar promotions and like...
Yeah.
Number 2 from episode 95 is the zero-day downloadable content announced for Civilization V, Disrespecting the Customer.
This should be good for some conversation.
Yeah. Ramp up the controversy again.
Exactly. This thread, started by Fungus420, says, I've come to the conclusion that the zero-day downloadable content, as announced, amounts to disrespect and contempt by the company towards Civ fans, quote-unquote, and as we find out later, he's referring to Civ developer Firaxis Games. Continuing, he says, having a zero-day DLC that provides a special gun or an armor or something is pretty normal and well-accepted, but this is not what Firaxis is doing here with Babylon. Typical zero-day DLC is designed and marketed towards hardcore fans and usually provides some type of minor cheating or aesthetic consideration, like the collector gun or dragon armor in Mass Effect. It makes no effect on the actual gameplay, storyline, or core game, quote-unquote. Just going to back up a bit for our listeners to what are we talking about, and it appears that he is referring to those who acquire the deluxe edition of Civilization V, which is to include Babylonian Civilization as Civilization number 19. There is also, however, those who order Civ V from Steam to receive the downloadable bonus content, Cradle of Civilization Map Pack Mesopotamia. I guess I'll continue reading his post and then I have some definition issues here. What Firaxis is doing with Babylon is investing the time and energy to create a full new Civ and then intentionally removing it from the base game merely as a way to build customers that already intend on purchasing the main product. This is just downright disrespectful. The whole Steam thing, I can understand. I personally don't like it, but it's sound business. Digital rights management has to be implemented, and Steam is known for being unobtrusive and is quite popular amongst most gamers. What I do not understand or agree with on any level is intentionally removing core game content in an effort to squeeze loyal fans for more dollars. As I said, it's just plain disrespectful and shallow. So Firaxis, I wag my finger at thee, unquote. And it also includes a smiley right afterwards that does just that. Let's be clear on a couple of things before I get to the downloadable content issue. A lot of this, and it didn't come up in the first handful of pages in this 14-page thread as of this recording, so maybe it did come up a little later, that this is a decision not by Firaxis Games, CIF or developer, but the publisher 2K Games. So if you want to direct concern in this regard, whether it be constructive concern or not, as some people engage in, then you want to direct it at 2K. But he's talking about Babylon as DLC, but this is Babylon that is coming part of the deluxe edition, which do not have to purchase from Steam. So what it is it's $10 more for Babylon, but not just Babylon, for, I think, Cradle of Civilization map pack, and then as well as the video. So besides those definitions, my position as far as Babylon is that it's not part of the core gameplay. It's something extra. If it's something that you're interested in and getting right from the outset, then you can purchase that. If you don't like that, it's not that you're going to be denied Babylon. It's, as some people pointed out, no doubt someone will mod a Babylonian civilization. So if you really want a Babylonian civilization, just wait a little bit and you'll have it anyway.
My only question is how it affects multiplayer balance. Is there any inherent advantage to doing so? Because really there wouldn't be for most Civ 4 Civs. And I guess if someone could use Rome and you couldn't, but even there, you could usually deal with that, so I don't know.
This really bothers me as a both consumer and as a gamer. I say that one civilization isn't that core gameplay, but this really is not the same as selling, you know, special units in a collector's unit of a Total War game where you get different uniforms, but they're still rifles with different names. This is an entire civilization you will have to pay 10 extra dollars for. And yeah, you get the extra video and the making of stuff and a map or a tech tree. That's all traditional collector's edition stuff. But a new civilization, a civilization that has always been a part of the civilization experience. It was one of the very first civilization. Nebuchadnezzar, finally we're seeing him instead of Hammurabi, yay Nebuchadnezzar. I think this is pushing collector's content too far. This is a new experience that is not going to be available to gamers to begin with. Relying on the mod community is a cop-out. That's okay, the community will give you what the developers have traditionally given you, but won't now. You have to pay for it. Who knows if they will even allow a Babylonian mod somehow, so they have their own clearinghouse, their own activating system for mods within Civ 5, which is great. It won't be the same Babylon. There will be 5 or 6 competing Babylonian mods for the first year. Eventually, it'll be sold as separate DLC and as an expansion pack. But I think this is wrong. I think it is wrong to have a civilization you have to pay extra for, especially one that's central and core. So many Civ players want that extra civilization, and they will pay the extra money for it. You can say, well, okay, then you're buying it and you're making a choice. And I will make that choice. I'm stupid and I'm an idiot and I love civilization, so I'm going to make the choice. But I'm not going to like it. And I think this is a bad pattern, and it's going to continue if it's a success. And the next expansion pack will be a collector's edition of that. Only now, if you want the Polynesians, you have to pay an extra $10. This is not the same as Civ 4, where it's a bunch of different traits and it's mix and match. A lot of energy is being put into this, and I think every civilization player should have a chance to see every civilization based on if they want to play this game, not if they have 10 extra dollars to spend. I think it's wrong.
Problem is, they can get away with it, and they probably will in your case, too, since you're saying you're going to buy it.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the unfortunate reality of it. And as much as you don't like it,
yeah,
they're trying to make money, and if they can...
I'm not saying it's a bad business decision. I'm not saying I'm a strong man, by any means. I'm certainly weak in many ways. But it doesn't mean I like it. It doesn't mean I think it's ethical. It's a great business decision. They're going to make a ton of money off of it. But there are tons of ways gaming companies are making money off of us in selling DLC. How much did Bethesda make off of Horse Armor and Oblivion? Something completely useless, and they sold tons of it because we're all idiots. I just don't like where this is going.
Well, I think philosophically speaking, the difference between selling downloadable content on day one and selling an XP a year later, it's the same deal. Except that now, on an XP, everyone moves to the expansion pack pretty much. Everyone bought Warlords, everyone bought Beyond the Sword. Now you're getting, on day one of the game being released, two different versions. And presumably, it's likely going to be in the same lobby playing against the same people. So to me, the problem isn't that we're paying for a 19th Civ. Because unlike some people who are posting that they think, oh, they're ripping a Civ out of the base game. Well, the base game comes with 18 Civs. That's all that a sieve vanilla has ever had, is 18 sieves. So for your money, you're getting your 18 sieves. And if you want to pay 10 extra dollars, you're getting a 19 sieve. And you're right. A sieve is not a piece of armor or a nice-looking eye candy. It's core gameplay. When you have, especially in multiplayer, an 8-person free-for-all, and only 2 people can get Babylon out of a random sieve pick there, that's a problem.
And if the other DLC are other civilizations, if they're all releases, this is just, it's a multiplied problem.
Yes, it's going to snowball. And yes, eventually, probably in the first expansion pack, I imagine there still will be expansion packs, they'll roll the previous DLC into it and sell it for whatever they think rips out of our pockets. Mm-hmm. To me, it's not so much of a moral issue with selling us stuff. It's a mechanics issue with multiplayer and, of course, with mods. Can our modders friggin' make a Babylon sieve? Even if they use no code and no art from 2K. There wouldn't be any specific legal action, probably, but is 2K going to host those mods on their community hub? I would think probably not. So that's another issue, and if I was a modder, I'd be really concerned about this.
I agree.
Speaking, because I'm primarily a multiplayer, that if there isn't in some sort of in-game checkbox you can use to disable DLC, we're just going to have to make our own community rules to do the same thing, to make it a fair sandbox again. We won't have any choice, otherwise there's no conflict in the MP sandbox as it is without creating more, because you can have Babylon and I can't.
One could argue that such disparities between like people who have certain aspects of the game who don't have existed in some form or another with the practice of selling expansion packs. I think the primary difference here is that disparity is more graded, and as was said before, that these different versions will be coming out on the same day.
I forget who posted it in the thread, and I alluded it to before in terms of what you get with your Civilization V editions. And strictly speaking, looking at the Babylonian Civilization, the standard edition, whether you pre-order it or you just order it after release, you don't get it. It's only in the deluxe edition, pre-order or not pre-ordered. When it comes to the Fertile Crescent map, which is the cradle of civilization, which is the part of this we haven't really talked about yet, in the standard edition, pre-order, and in the deluxe edition, it's free. But if you don't pre-order the standard or the deluxe edition, then it's looking like it's not going to be free, and then that's something that you can get afterwards for X amount of dollars. Firaxis and 2K have already set precedent with downloadable content in the console world of Civ with Civilization Revolution, where some actually was free in the case of there was a single map pack called Brave New Worlds released in late 2008. And at the same time, they also released the Victory Pack Scenario Pack, which was $1.25 American on the PlayStation Network. And then with Xbox Live, you buy so many Microsoft points, and it was 100 MS points. I assume that's like the equivalent to $1.25 US.
Yeah, I have no doubt that after 2K and Steam have figured they've gotten all the pre-sales they're going to get out of this, soon after release, you'll be able to download the DLC, Ildabaoth, in the map pack for X dollars, whether it be $2 or $5 or whatever. They'll probably make it available to the consumer at some minor cost and try and squeeze a few more dollars out of this.
Or they'll put it out for free a few weeks later, like BioWare did with some of the Mass Effect stuff. The first few DLCs they put out were actually free. They may wait a month or two after the game comes out, and then Babylon may be free for download.
Gears of War did that with its map packs, but I just didn't buy them until they became free then.
Some people are making the argument that, of course, DLC downloadable content, this is going to be just like with Civ, like it is with a number of gaming franchises. Now, this is the new order in terms of expansion packs. Rather than having a whole bunch of things packaged together a little later after release, you'll have, even on the day of release, and then interspersed at times, smaller components that you would otherwise see in an expansion pack. And some people argue that this is good because, oh, I would really like to get, for instance, this extra civilization, but it includes all of this other stuff too, and it costs $10. Babylon is just strictly downloadable content. Maybe it'll just be a dollar or two, and then that way you can pick and choose what you want. I can see that argument well, but I think it is the snowball effect, and I understand some people are concerned that if this is where it starts, where does it end, especially when you look at other gaming titles in terms of how they do their downloadable content, both in terms of what that downloadable content is and the timing. Companies trying to make more money,
Well, I understand that, and I think that just in terms of how they deliver that downloadable content, if they alienate the community too much in terms of how they're doing this, then in the end, they may find themselves losing money because as much as people would like to play the game, in terms of how they can acquire the game legally, it's just going to be too much of a pain. So I think it has potential benefits for both the user and the company, but in terms of not only how they do it, but also in terms of how they market it, just need to be careful so it's not one step forward, two steps back in terms of getting the content that people want and maybe only the content that they want. Like, I want to just pay for Babylon. I don't care about your video about how you made it. I don't want to have to pay $10. Just give me Babylon for free. In addition to that, the mechanics item that was mentioned, such as in multiplayer, so that people are informed in terms of setting up a match, for instance, okay, who has the ability to play Babylon? I don't have the ability to play, but you do. Do we want then to allow you to be able to play Babylon even though that I can't? Or do we want to say that you can play, but we're just going to disable your ability to play Babylon or whatever the unique is? Depending on how it was implemented, there's also some interface questions as well in terms of how complicated that would be. Was that something you'd be able to see at a glance in a lobby, or would you have to strike up a conversation with someone to find out? So what version of Civ 5 do you have today?
Yes, compatibility becomes a big question mark here that hasn't really been clarified. Especially when you get to the point where you maybe have two or three DLCs later, and in a year they come up with an expansion pack. Traditionally, expansion patch means total incompatibility. You can't play the previous game, but how is it going to work with Civ 5? The next pack is a large DLC, really? Or is it going to be like a traditional X-Pack? It could be a mess.
Expansion packs are different because they often add major gameplay changes. They're not just new content. One reason why there's all this incompatibility. But yeah, I mean, the question is, how are different versions of Civ going to play with each other? And what do the players think is important?
I have another concern. Yeah, I don't think we've hashed on it yet, but it could be equally bad. And that's the quality and balance of each of these DLCs that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Just to say some examples from Civ 4, the code for the United Nations resolutions and Apostolic Palace resolutions, mechanics behind capitulation and peaceful vassaling, they're god-awful. I don't know how they made a final game. That's the kind of stuff that you would be a little painful to see in beta. The AI will pick a UN resolution, fits the chair, rolls a dice. It doesn't have any strategic basis for doing that. So if our DLC is going to see a lot of features added that are like that, then it could be a problem. And then the other thing is, when you have piecemeal additions of mechanics, say you added a Rome with a 12-strength Praetorian or something, that could potentially happen if you're releasing things every now and then, or something that just completely destroys the current metagame to the extent where, you know, it just breaks the game. And when you're adding features piecemeal, that's much more likely to happen than it would be if you were to test out an entire new patch, an entire new set of DLC or whatever. So we have significant balance and then quality issues to address if we're going to be doing, like, just monthly or whatever DLC options.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff is only going to see more frequency when there's less time to test it between when the thing gets made and when it's released.
Not to mention what it does to a community. How big is the Civ community if everyone's playing with a different 20 civilizations?
Yeah, well, there's that too.
They may be able to help themselves out a little bit with some of the balance if it's one of those, well, let's have 10 things that we're going to release as downloadable content just to choose a nice round number. And then decide, okay, we're going to develop all of that simultaneously, but we're going to release it staggered.
It's still dangerous.
Oh, I don't disagree. It doesn't address everything, and that might be something that might be helpful, but until it's actually released, even then, I mean, you have beta testers, but if you're not necessarily going to know what the ultimate effects are going to be, and I'm not saying that's a be-all and end-all solution, but that might be something for them to consider.
Right.
It'll curb it, but again, you're not going to see the potential on those until they're all out. Once you release them one by one, it might have a different effect on gameplay than if you released all 10, too. That kind of stuff is very hard to predict, because even if you have very good beta testers, people at the top of the game, you're not going to have a lot of them, and you're not going to have a lot of time for them to really iron out the worst problems that may arise once it hits the wild, so to speak. And game balance is a tricky thing. It is not easy to do that. That's one of the reasons that the games that manage it are so popular, so famous, and so well acclaimed, is that it's so difficult to get that done correctly. It's like stepping on landmines when you're doing something like this, where you're changing the balance, reasonable frequency.
There was one comment in this discussion that I disagreed with completely, which was from Arstall, where he's saying, not so much about this is all part of bringing the quote-unquote superior console experience to your PCs. That was the first part of his point. But then he says, too bad not enough people care for a difference to be made. I think just this thread alone demonstrates that there are people who are concerned, and they are voicing that, and they're discussing that. Some with greater effect than others. If you're going to criticize, do so constructively, and hopefully in your constructive criticism you actually are making a reasonable argument. If we are going to say criticize, make it constructive, it's more likely that Fraxis and indeed 2K, who are no doubt making these final decisions, will be listening to what the community is saying. It has already been touched upon as we're getting some information about downloadable content, but not the whole experience in terms of how it affects this, that, and the other thing. Hopefully maybe there'll be somebody from 2K, for instance, to clarify some of these points. I think the one point that did get clarified was someone saying, oh, they'll probably charge for patches now.
No.
That was already clarified, I think, on the 2K forums. No, patches would not be like charged downloadable content. You could argue that anything that you download is downloadable content. Really, right? The paid version there, let's qualify that. Official paid downloadable content.
Although there's been talk of that in the gaming community recently, and it's been disturbing some people, paying for patches. From what I understand, it came up regarding Infinity Ward's Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, which I play, so I was privy to it. But there's so much cheating in that game. And I don't mean, like, using glitches to, you know, glitch off the map or something. I mean cheating. I mean people who are hacking game files to allow nukes in care package or weapons that are supposed to be, like, semi-automatic, firing full auto and just destroying people. Or, like, people have the ability to see other people through walls because of the hacks. People are saying, well, I would pay to fix this. Well, that's something that really should be being fixed by Infinity Ward, like, now, because it's a major issue. And if that kind of stuff starts getting charged, it's not going to be good for gaming.
I don't think anyone can say that the Civ community doesn't care about the issue. There's pages and pages of threads on Steam and DLC and DRM. Not all of it all that educated and logical, mind you, but it definitely shows that the community is concerned about the issue. We hope 2K at least produces a model that doesn't divide the community anyway. I don't think any of us have anything against 2K making some cash, as long as it's done right.
Yeah, I think that's where the lack of information, how everything's going to fit together, that is my big concern. I do really want to have everyone to be able to play Babylon. I do think this is a major issue. Sharing the experience, that's a big part of civilization, is the community. But that's not going to happen, so at least they can give us some information about how everything's going to work.
And I think likely, just like so much about Civ 5 right now, we're probably not hearing a whole bunch about some stuff, simply because it either hasn't been designed or the decisions haven't been made yet. So hopefully they will open up more, make decisions, and educate the community, because knowledge is power. And it'll make people feel, even if they don't agree with 2K, at least they'll know what the lay of the land is.
Number 5, from episode 101.
And that really, I guess you could almost say that came directly from Khan, equipping his people en masse and training them en masse. He had a huge army that knew how to ride and had great weapons, and no one could stand up to him.
For all you nerds out there, that's Genghis Khan, not Kong Noonien Soon from Star Trek. Just how we make that clear.
Number 4, from episode 87.
Barbarian transports, barbarian destroyers, barbarian battleships. There you go, Phil. You happy now?
Nuke him. As long as they actually have a counter, unlike barbed galleys on high levels.
I think barbarian battleships is... I draw the line at barbarian battleships.
Well, how can you disagree with alliteration? Alliteration is so cool. Barbarian battleship. It's just a natural fit.
Yeah, you would definitely want fighters.
Number 3, from episode 106...
All right, this ranting and bit session has been brought to you by...
Oh, no, we're not done yet. But, okay, we should probably get to the more relevant ranting and bit.
Who needs actual topics? You can just listen to us. I'm sure that all your listeners listen to us for the ranting and bit.
Is there ever anything else?
Number 2, from episode 96.
And now he's saying that Sitting Bull has some bronze and is building up dog workers. What's a dog?
Warrior.
This is what I really wish Polycast had some fan art, I'm telling you.
But anyway, he's afraid of simple dog workers, and he still thinks he should easily be able to wipe them out since he's behind in tech. But
I don't know, those dog workers are efficient.
I just have this mental image of a little puppy pulling them out.
Gotta hand it to them dog workers, though. I mean, they're loyal, they put their nose to the ground and keep on trucking. Yeah, they're good workers.
Honorable mention from episode 107.
Yeah, but usually, of course, on the internet, it's everybody gets to have their opinion, which is that everybody else's opinion is wrong. But, yeah, okay.
Well, just yours.
I disagree with that opinion.
I disagree with your disagreement.
Uh-huh.
But that doesn't mean I agree. Oh, no, double negative.
This is the internet. Logic doesn't count.
And number one, from episode 85, a proposed solution for the infamous Stack of Doom.
So who would like to introduce this topic?
10% for every unit above 3. What the hell?
There's your introduction. No, this thread is by Hans Lemmerson. I hope I'm reading that correctly.
I think so.
The gist of the thread is he's saying that the Stack of Doom is such a predominant thing in civilization that it's incentive to get rid of that. And it's been around for a long time. This particular idea is suggesting a percentage strength penalty, I'm assuming. He just says negative 10%. I'm assuming that's to its base strength instead of 4 for every unit above 3. And then he goes on to say that stacks are possible, but now you have some disincentive for making absolutely huge stacks. Oh, and then there's a threshold, apparently, for a stacking penalty. Now, this has some interesting gameplay implications, and like any other suggestion, in my opinion, its effects on other aspects of gameplay would have to be considered very carefully. For example, just coming to mind immediately is if you have a stack, then anything over a certain number is extremely vulnerable to flanking. So your siege would go from very powerful to almost useless on the offensive because you'd only have small stacks of units, and you wouldn't be able to make a balanced stack anymore and still have sufficient numbers of seeds. You'd just get flanked like crazy if you had like a 30-unit stack because nothing, including your pikes, would be able to defend against the horse archers and knights. Your siege would just die in droves. Whereas if you split your stack up, then if you had spears or whatever to stop the horse archers, then axes would just murder them instead and the siege wouldn't defend. So all of a sudden, the attacker would go from having at least some advantage in terms of that to having absolutely none. Like, you wouldn't be able to do anything. So you'd have to change the balance of units in that regard as well. It's an interesting idea, but it would be hard to implement it under the current structure of the game.
And on the defense side, if you were limited to only 3 before you started getting defense penalties, what if somebody rolls up with, like, 3 or 4 of those mini-stacks? You're screwed. Because you only have 3 units in the city, even if it has a really good defense. City walls and everything.
That's true. Attacking initiative would be even larger than it is, I guess, currently.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder if it's 10%, as was already said, for the base attack, say, of the attacker, and then on the defensive side, say, minus 10% defensive, and then we can get into the whole offensive-defensive unit discussion again, no thanks. But anyway.
I want to make offensive units even stronger.
You know, I think this is designed, as I said, to get around the Stack of Doom, but then I'm thinking, man, I'm going to have all of these mini stacks so I don't have this 10% penalty. But actually, I'm starting to think maybe at some point I just want to have that many more units in my Stack of Doom so that 10%, especially if it's just from the base, it's going to be of an impact, but I would rather take the 10% penalty with this large stack for every unit rather than having to manage all of these little 3 or less unit stacks.
Yeah, that's true. The micromanagement would be a big issue as well. I've had some games on higher levels where I controlled over 300 units, and it just would not be fun to move 100 mini-stacks individually or whatever. For turn, it would be absolutely devastating in terms of gameplay.
In terms of how historically accurate it is, I was thinking, wouldn't it be more accurate to have, like, a bunch of little stacks in Tanya City? Because that's more what it's like. You don't have, like, 200,000 soldiers in one little plot of land.
Well, you do, because of what one plot of land represents in Civ. I mean, that's quite a number of miles in each direction. I mean, this is the same type of tile that an entire city can fit into.
Yeah, but they always complain about it being crowded, so.
Yeah, but that's the civilian population. These aren't organized military ranks. Maybe they wouldn't complain so much. But no, one tile on Civ, I forget, it's quite a number of miles by miles.
and pretty much any army that's ever existed could fit into one, to my knowledge.
At the same time, having the mini-stacks kind of camp out in front of a city, then people would probably pillage more, too. Also, lower in this thread, I think people started saying that instead of a hard cap, they should just have an exponential maintenance sort of cap, which I actually agree with, because I feel like once you get enough units, really that 10% just doesn't matter anymore. It's like, well, just build 3 more units, you know?
Yeah, kind of what I was saying, but if it was exponential, oh, yeah. Now you're kind of addressing that point.
Well, I mean, how weak would you make them? Like, if you had a 100-unit stack, would everything be taken down to 1 strength or 0 strength or what? They just lose every time, no matter what? It feels a little out of place if you go that far.
Probably not taking more than half.
But even there, you would have things like rifles beating infantry immediately, or, like, knights absolutely wrecking rifles, just destroying them like nothing.
Well, they can if you don't use them, right? So it's like it makes your role more like that of a general rather than, I don't know, a UPS man sending units.
Attacking would be so close to impossible with culture borders and everything else. Because the attacker would get to decide, I mean, the defender would always have the choice of attacking you first. And you would either be forced to split your stacks into stacks that really couldn't defend against a variety of unit attack types, or you'd be forced to take a global penalty on your stack for sending in a big stack. And it would just be frustrating, even with a tech lead and a numerical advantage, to have absolutely no hope against the defender just because he built 20 knights or something and gave them pinch. Because they wouldn't need shock because your pikes would be 3 strength.
Later in the threat, Hans does say that a city will be able to support more units without a penalty than open plains. And he says, sure, defense will be harder when you can't cram a stack of death into your city, but isn't a city with 5 units in it pretty well defended? If you're worried about an impending attack against a city with 5 fortified defenders, you have other problems besides an incremental penalty applied to large numbers of units all sharing the same tile.
See, that's where he's mistaken. The defense would not be harder. It would be nightmarishly easier. You don't defend by sitting in the city. You defend by wrecking the stack right when it gets near it. That's where it would be impossible on the attacker. Sure, you have a strength disadvantage while you're sitting in your city, but when you attack, you don't. So all that collateral gets done, if you even need collateral, with everything at negative 50% health, and then you just attack and attack and kill all their units. Or they send in things 3 at a time, and you can just block them. Get back to the unit funneling of old. Could you imagine what this would do to the AI if it sent in stacks of 3 at a time? You just park your own 3 units on a hill and force it onto the flatlands and then attack it 1 unit at a time, killing all its units, hundreds of units, 5 of yours lost at tech parity. I mean, it'd be funny, but I don't know if it's good for gameplay.
King Flevins talks about a hard cap, each tile having a holding capacity for 12, and then cities size 8 to 15 can hold 15 units, and then cities size 15 can have a holding capacity of 20 units. But Musk Havard says, I believe a much simpler way to resolve the problem is to reintroduce the zone of control system.
No.
Control is which we have discussed on Polycat before. But I think Trias, right on the first page of the thread, says, in general, I would avoid directly penalizing stacks if only on the grounds that penalties are generally unfun and a negative way of dealing with the problem. I still see the argument of concerns people have with regards to stacks of doom. So if you want to continue working on trying to find a way around it, but I don't think that this is the solution. And if you're that concerned about stacks of doom, just remember that you can make stacks of doom just as well as your opponents can. Even if you don't like it, you know it's power, so you should be taking advantage of that power.
I have so many units. If the Stack of Doom is such a saver in terms of fun, just being able to actually move all those units in a timely manner. I mean, some people like their games to take 10 hours or more. You know, one of the Beyond the Sword of the Month submissions that won had 66 hours locked, but not everybody likes doing that. And you're going to lose a lot of the audience if you force everybody to have minimum 10, 20-hour games. And that's if they're playing as fast as me, otherwise they'll be like 50, because they have to move hundreds of units just to have a chance on the highest difficulties.
And number one from episode 104.
It is time, in fact, for the quote-unquote real introduction to the show. And studies have shown that people are more likely to listen to Polycasts by about 78% when we have a woman who does the introduction and or the closing to the show.
When did you make up this statistic?
He just completely pulled this out of his ass. Is no such study.
98% of statistics are made up. The other 10% are miscalculations.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Thank you for listening to Polycast Evergreen, Season 4. I'm author Lucuta Snyders. From this time forward, you are in service to me.
Civilization 1 Clips, copyright MicroProse.
Civilization 4 Sound Clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.